Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program.
Hi, I'm Abby Dean.
And I'm Mick Ramos.
Today we're speaking with reporter and author Maya Solovitz on her most recent book, Unbroken Brain. In it, she puts forth a stunning new theory that addiction is a learned behavior, a type of learning disorder that requires a new way of thinking. Maya has written extensively about addiction treatment, public policy, and the science behind addiction for many national newspapers, including Time Magazine, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. She also brings personal experience to her reporting, having become addicted to cocaine and heroin as a teenager and finding recovery in her early 20s. As always, please subscribe to the Right Turn Radio Podcast on iTunes. Hi, Maya. It's Abby. So we love your premise. That's why you're on our radio show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, we've been trying to do it this way for a while, and it's nice that Mick teaches your book practically in his education course.
Oh, wow, that's great to hear. It's like I knew people were sort of converging on this, but it was sort of hard to know when writing it how many and, you know, where they were, especially because the mainstream of treatment is unfortunately so disconnected from the empirically supported treatments. Yeah, I mean, I'm really hoping to hear from more clinicians about, you know, how they do this in practice, because I think the whole overview, seeing it as a learning issue, obviously provides a good guide for teaching people to deal with it.
In the field, and we all, you know, the two of us are in the field, one of the things we see is, you know, you see the people who, you know, they've been had trouble since they were born and kind of, but then there are also the people who, you know, they looked like they were the promising athlete or they were the valedictorian and those kind of things. And our typical person coming into our program is someone who at the age of 22 to 24 has fallen out of their life doing drugs. And I think, and I really liked how your model fit with that.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, you know, the teen years are very, very difficult. They're particularly difficult in our environment of economic uncertainty and inequality, which I think is part of why we're seeing this unfortunate expansion of opioid misuse. But yeah, the, you know, a lot of really smart, really wonderful, really kind, lovely people become addicted. And one of the things to debunk in the book was this idea that there's this addictive personality that's completely selfish and mean and nasty and sort of filled with character defects. Certainly there are people with antisocial personality disorder who are absolutely overrepresented among people with addiction. However, about 8 of people with addiction do not have antisocial personality disorder. So
that's
it's
who we
very
see.
Unfair to, like, tell all the rest of us that we're liars and thieves and cheats and are inherently bad. But anyway, I think, yeah, when you have somebody who's 22 and 23 and the cortex is, like, just beginning to be able to give them control, you know, that's where you really do see a lot of people starting recovery. And that's where, you know, I think a lot of help can be useful.
How does your background, how's that influenced where you've gotten to at this point?
I mean, yeah, that's sort of a complicated question, but you know, I definitely think that if I had been a child today, I would have been diagnosed on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. I was a kid who read at 3. I was extremely hypersensitive to sounds and touch and noise and bright lights and just all kinds of taste. Sensory thing, you know, I had very classic symptoms, and I was very socially inept. I think that sort of outsiderness and that feeling of being very different definitely had a huge impact, and it gave me both strengths and weaknesses. I think, you know, being on the outside gives you a different perspective, which can often help you see the problems with the inside. And, you know, just having these sensory differences made me aware, ultimately, that people's nervous systems can be extremely extremely different from each other. And while we should always try to empathize, we have to realize that when we do empathize, we're projecting our own self into someone else. And, like, I might absolutely hate crowds and think a parade is a horrible thing, but most people don't feel that way.
Right.
So, you know, it's like if I misproject that and figure, well, nobody would ever want to go to one of those things, I would obviously be quite wrong and be misinterpreting the other person's perspective quite severely on obviously a trivial example. But, you know, so that, you know, that certainly made a difference. Obviously, being middle class and white protected me from a lot of stuff, and I'm well aware that the way we deal with drugs is inextricable from the racist and ongoingly racist, unfortunately, history of this country. Mm-hmm. So,
do you want to go into that more in more detail? Because
sure.
I know you did in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing to me is just that if you look at the history of our drug laws, they are so clearly racist. It's like you get the cocaine laws being passed because ideas that it made black men impervious to bullets, which might be a good thing, actually. We had, you know, all this stuff about, like, fears of, like, white men that Chinese men would use opium to, like, rape or seduce white women, and all this stuff about, you know, Mexicans, and their satanic swing and jazz, which also obviously associated with black people, you know, are just corrupting the white. I mean, it's just like you read this stuff and it's laughable, but then you realize, like, this created the laws that we have now. Like, our laws are not based on science. There was no, like, commission to say, okay, let's make alcohol legal and marijuana illegal because, you know, the harms for marijuana are clearly more severe, because that's just not true. You know, it's like our drug laws are a historical accident, and we treat them as if they were sort of handed down by God, almost. And now I think we're beginning to realize, probably because white people are being affected, that this is a dumb way to deal with this problem.
One of the things that I found really interesting is you're a white woman who got into this. You got into heroin. You got into cocaine. Can you tell us a little about, you know, as, you know, here you are a white woman and you know you're free because you're a white woman, but how did it happen? How did you get into drugs?
I was, like I said, I was a sort of outsider-y kid, and by the time I hit my teens, I was sort of desperate for social connection, and I'd always had these sort of obsessive interests from, like, you know, opera and science fiction, which obviously most kids would not be into, and then I developed this obsessive interest in drugs, which lots of people were into, and so I got into the Grateful Dead and psychedelics and lots of pot, and, you know, if I had stuck with that, I probably would have outgrown it, but unfortunately, it was the 80s, and people thought that cocaine was not addictive, and I found myself, you know, doing cocaine with Jerry, so, like, you're going to do it.
the only way to go.
I was probably going to do it anyway, but the, you know, the milieu was completely, in New York City in the 80s, like, it's hard to describe just how prevalent cocaine was at Columbia College in the 80s. It was just everywhere. And so, you know, I just thought it was normal. And, you know, I mean, I think that even the national statistics show that something like 50% of people who were in college during those years in the early 80s and late 70s, 50% tried cocaine. That's, like, huge, and we've never had that ever again. And that was sort of the beginning of the lead-in to the worst excesses of the war on drugs, but I was at the beginning of it. And so, you know, we thought, oh, it's harmless, which is horrifying to think of now. But so the heroin happened actually after I got suspended from Columbia because I was selling coke. And then, you know, I thought I had ruined my life and everything was over, and so why not? And that became my real drug of choice, because that really allowed me to just turn down the volume on everything. Like, cocaine, to some extent, made it more intense. But heroin just allowed me to chill, which was... And so, you know, that's basically what happened. I also want to say that, like, 50% of all people with heroin addiction have been white since the 70s. If you just think about it, who are our icons of heroin? We've got, like, Kurt Cobain, Lou Reed. These are white dudes. William Burroughs. Ginsburg. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, these are white dudes. And the, you know, yes, there was, of course, the association, you know, Billie Holiday and jazz and all that. But the counterculture and the beat sort of heroin thing has been in white for a very long time.
Yeah, and I think recently, because it's been white young men and women, that it's gotten become a national, quote-unquote, national epidemic. One of the things, and I really love the perspective you bring to the show, but one of the things we talked about here when Mick and I were talking, it's the... we agree with some of your premises, but when things get summarized, you get summarized as being against AA and against interventions. And what I've noticed in your book is you're a lot more nuanced than that. Can you kind of explain those two things that are, you know, that's why you're getting front page news, but it's not exactly
sure,
what you're saying?
Sure, that is driving me nuts, actually. I am not opposed to 12-step programs. I personally benefited from 12-step programs. What I am opposed to is paying for 12-step programs, which should be free.
Yes.
I am opposed to the content of treatment being 12-step, not only because you can get that for free elsewhere, but also because it violates the First Amendment, and it has a lot of other issues for women and people of color, and for white men even. So the idea of powerlessness is often counterproductive. There are a lot of things that are problematic with forcing the 12 steps on people, none of which are problematic about people voluntarily engaging in the nice and often useful moral process of going through the steps. So what I am trying to say is, let AA be AA, let treatment be treatment. I've sort of summarized this as, your oncologist is not your support group. And we pay for the oncologist and we don't pay for the support group, and that's as it should be. So that is really what I think about 12-step programs. I absolutely think that, you know, social support is a critical part of recovery, and so people should be given multiple options and referrals for self-support after treatment, including 12-step programs, because they are free and widely available.
Thank you for saying that. You put that very nicely. It's our philosophy here as well. The other thing you were talking about is, you know, the old version of tough love and the old version of interventions, and
which is still shown on TV, I might add.
Yes, we've watched it and critiqued it on this actual show.
Yes. Well, so, and I mean, I think that, like, you know, when I am opposed, and I say explicitly I'm opposed to the confrontational, you know, get everybody together and yell at them kind of intervention.
The public shaming, yes.
You know, what I am in favor of is Kraft Family Therapy, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where it's a much more gentle and empathetic and supportive approach, and it's twice as effective when it's been compared head-to-head with those interventions where you, you know, get together, even if you get together in a sort of nice way. So I think, you know, I think most of the time it's really better to recognize that recovery is a process, and that the best way to get the person fully engaged in the process is to have them want to be fully engaged in the process. And the best way to do that is to attract them into recovery by showing them that life is possible, bearable, and actually even happier in recovery. And the way you do that is by attracting them and not by, you know, trying to force them.
Nicely put.
Beautifully said. Yeah, I kind of want to pivot a second to a personal interest. You know, in my groups that I do here personally, the science of addiction is something that we talk about a lot, as something that can be useful to engage with, useful to discuss, useful to understand for folks here who are in treatment. You know, sharing research is a and staying on top of that is a big part of what I do. And I wanted to ask you, after writing this and through all of your experience, what kinds of education around addiction do you think is important for those who are in treatment now to hear?
Well, I think it's actually important for people to hear that it often isn't chronic. And that doesn't mean you can go and use tomorrow.
Yes.
What that means is that you have good odds of recovery.
Yeah.
And that it often isn't a lifelong thing. Again, that doesn't mean you can go and use whatever your substance is safely in 10 years or whatever. What it does mean is that the odds of recovery are a lot better than you have been told.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of people, get out of these problems without seeing themselves as having a chronic progressive disease. The progressive thing is just nonsense. The data shows that every year, with increasing age, more people are likely to get into recovery. So if it were progressive, fewer people should be likely to get into recovery with age, since it should be impossible once you get a certain age, right? But that is not the case. The other thing that I think is important is that you need to find another passion. And this is a lot easier said than done. But addiction is really like falling in love with the wrong person. You fell in love with a drug rather than a person.
Mm-hmm.
And now, every time you hear that song or you see that street corner or you whatever it is, you're going to think of that person and you're going to want to go back to them. And you can't do that because that person's bad for you and that drug is bad for you. So, we've all gotten over breakups. It totally sucks. It changes your brain profoundly, but it's not permanent brain damage. And it doesn't mean that, you are going to have to struggle a particular breakup for the rest of your life. So I think if we look at it that way, it's a lot, people can relate, understand it, and it explains why cues and stress increase craving. And it is more accurate in terms of the prognosis. Again, this doesn't mean, just like if you were madly in love with somebody who didn't love you, it would be a very bad idea to see them again.
Absolutely. And I think
similarly, it's an equally bad idea to say, oh yeah, now I can use coke on weekends. It's not likely to happen.
Right.
That's right. I'm just gonna date him this weekend, Mom. Don't worry about it.
So, yeah. Right. This is and similarly, the level of attachment is the problem.
I think that's nice. It's wonderfully put, and I want to thank you for letting us talk to you about your book. The Unbroken Brain it just kind of summarizes a lot of things that we've been talking about here. I was trying to explain to people that it was all our ideas, but someone else had written them down, and it's very exciting to have it out there and creating a buzz for whatever reason. So thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot, Maya.
Thank you.
Okay, cool. Take care.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.